här är Internationell författarscen och jag heter Ida Linde.
Och jag heter Athena Farrokhzad och vi är programansvariga för litteraturen här på Kulturhuset Stadsteatern.
Alldeles strax ska ni få höra författaren Sadie Smith i samtal med Hanna Nordenhök.
Varmt välkomna.
Vad gör ni nu?
Ingenting alls. Jag bor i Sir Roger Tichborns hus och gör ingenting.
Och har det varit så sedan ni lämnade Sydney?
Ja.
Följde er hustru med er hem?
Hon är död.
Era barn?
Ett av dem följde med mig hem.
Var är han?
I skolan.
Och är det Sir Roger Tichborne, som ni kallar honom, som bekostar hans skolgång?
Ja, han betalar 6 pund per kvartal för honom och när han kommer hem under ledigheterna vistas han i huset.
Bodde ni hos pretendenten i Sydney?
Nej, inte en timme. Jag fick inte så mycket som 6 pence av honom i Sydney.
Ni är mycket precis.
Nej, inte så precis som ni tror.
Och ni svär på att ni aldrig bodde hos honom?
Ja, jag svär på att jag aldrig bodde hos honom så mycket som 10 minuter.
Så om han har uppgett för någon att hans farbrors betjänt, det vill säga ni, bodde hos honom på Pitt Street, så är det inte sant?
Nej, det är osant.
Ni säger att han aldrig bad er om någon information angående sitt tidigare liv och sin familj?
Nej, aldrig.
Och hela tiden då ni var på väg hem med honom och när ni bodde i hans hus här i London, ställde han aldrig någon fråga för att inhämta information?
Inte ett ord, så vitt jag kan minnas.
Gav ni honom någonsin något med anknytning till familjen?
Nej, inget.
Gav ni honom någonsin något annat än information? Kanske artiklar eller föremål?
Jag tror att jag gav honom ett porträtt av Sir Edward Doughty och ett blad ur en bok som jag hade.
Och när var detta?
I Sydney.
Hur kommer det sig att ni gav honom porträttet?
Jag gav det egentligen inte till honom. Jag tog med det för att visa honom och han skickade iväg det och fick en kopia gjord och jag har mitt kvar.
Av vilken anledning?
Jag vet inte, han berättade aldrig varför han ville ha det.
Gav ni honom någonsin en ritning över delar av egendomen?
En ritning? Ja, jag visade honom en ritning över Upton House, en bild snarare, och det är allt jag har.
Hade ni någon bild, ritning eller karta över Hermitage-området i Wapping?
Nej, och jag hade aldrig hört talas om det förrän jag såg det i tidningen.
Så om han någonsin sa att ifall ni råkade ha hans farbrors porträtt och dessutom en ritning av en del av Hermitage Estate som han kunde låta kopiera, då skulle det inte vara sant?
Nej, absolut inte. Vad gäller kartan. Däremot gav jag honom porträttet av hans farbror.
Och bladet ur en bok.
Ja, det gjorde jag. Tack och välkomna till Internationell författarscen. Jag heter Ida Linde.
Och jag heter Athena Farrokhzad och vi är tillsammans ansvariga för litteraturen här på Kulturhuset Stadsteatern.
Boken vi just läste ur heter Bedragaren som finns utgiven av Albert Bonniers förlag i en fantastisk översättning av Niklas Nilsson.
Och ikväll är hon här, Sadie Smith. Denna litteraturens världsstjärna. Och vi är så glada för det. Och hon kommer att samtala med ingen mindre än vår egen stjärna, Hanna Nordenhök.
Yes!
Och samtalet pågår i en timme ungefär. Och efter det så blir det bokförsäljning och signering i foajén. Varmt välkomna.
Och nu, welcome on stage, Sadie Smith och Hanna Nordenhök.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, lady. Hey.
Sadie?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so happy to sit here with you. I'm so honored to talk about this wonderful novel. Really an experience to read. I mean, when I think about this novel, I mean, one could say that in our times, I mean, in times of post-truth, of fake news, of propaganda wars, but also in times when life itself almost feels like it's become a constant media spectacle, where almost all of us, to some extent, become fraudsters. I mean, in a time like that, in that type of zeitgeist, it feels to me that as an author today, it's almost impossible not to think about the significance of lie and deceit and fraud in society and what that means to us. And in this meanderingly composed novel, the story revolves around the historical case of a fraudster in 1860s England, who claims to be Sir Roger Tichborne, aristocrat inheritor of an enormous fortune that everybody thought was dead at sea. And this scamster, or the claimant, pretendenten, as he's called in the novel, he's an obvious fraud. He has nothing of the manners and knowledge he should possess, being Sir Tichborne. And everything points towards him being a simple butcher with enormous debts and so on. And yet he gets hordes of loyal followers of seduced by his story. So I'm really curious to know how did this historical material come to you?
I mean, I was thinking about it for a long time, you know, about 12 years on and off, and the kind of contemporary parallels that happened in the meantime. Like, when you're writing a novel, you can feel that everything in the world is happening because it's in your novel. It's like a narcissistic fit that novelists fall into. But on the other side of it, I can definitely see that the real connection is between the Victorian period and now. So that tendency towards fraud, when you think about, for example, all the millennial frauds from people like the Thanatos woman or the fire festival or whatever, the question why those frauds exist, to me, it's not a personal moral question, it's structural. So when you have societies in which people cannot move, cannot find a way to be successful or move in a meritocratic way, or when it feels stuck and when it feels unjust, fraud happens. When I think about all those millennial fraudsters, obviously you shouldn't commit fraud, guys, but also in a society where you can't get decent housing, where you can't get a decent education, where the kind of things which were available to my generation have disappeared, fraud becomes, an option. And I think in the Victorian period, you have a similar situation of massive inequality. And the system in which Tichborne was trying to make his way is one in which the courts are unbelievably biased against working class people. So you have to try and remember in England in which you could be, you know, hung for stealing sugar, hung for stealing a sheep, hung for minor infractions, over and over again, by juries who were entirely aristocratic. That system had been going on for a long time. So to me, the emphasis is not on the sin of the fraudster, but on the inequities of the system which necessitate the fraud. Mm.
Yeah, and not only the class aspect. I mean, slavery and the transatlantic slave trade has also a significant part of this novel.
Well, that's the greatest iniquity of them all. There's a series of, I guess, frauds in the book. Some of them are very benign, like one of the main characters is a writer who has no talent. This is one of the most benign frauds you can... It's fine to be an untalented writer. There's nothing wrong with that. But then you move from there to the frauds of the courts, to the fraud of the political system in England, and to this enormous fraudulent relationship between England and Jamaica, which is underpinning the whole enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that fraudulent relationship between the quote-unquote first world and the third quote-unquote third world persists. You know, it's also present in the world we're living in. So I think that's what engaged me, is that the Victorian period is a period in which interpersonally everybody is lying all the time about everything and to themselves, which felt very familiar to me. And then it's also a time structurally where people are living off the misery of others while choosing to ignore that fact, which also felt very familiar. And then that old, in my country, we have that Catholic writer and thinker, G.K. Chesterton, said this amazing thing that people can always ignore something as long as it's big enough, which is a very good line. And so that interested me too, that people seem amazed that something as large as a system of racialized capital could be ignored by so many people for so long. But to me, something like the environmental apocalypse right now offers a perfect analogy. Like, it's really, really possible to even be aware of that apocalypse and get on a plane like I did today.
Mm. Yeah. It's the state of repression. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it's constant.
It's constant, yeah. But I mean... You really feel with the novel that it's the fraudster mind or something, or the mindset of an epoch that also mirrors our time. But it's also that this feeling that lie and fraud is also something almost as like a virus in all human behavior. We have so many relations in the novel. I mean, for example, Eliza. That is this Scottish widow that is the cousin of the failed novel writer you talked about, William, and she watches him through her sort of very revealing lens, because she can see all the narcissistic and failing aspects of his personality and so on. But who is she? Who is Eliza in this novel?
I think I was quite interested in that novelistic way of viewing the world. You know, it's very entertaining, it's very ironic, it's very piercing, but it's also pretty ineffective. Like, it's very pleasant to walk through the world judging everybody, their hypocrisies and their small failures and finding them funny. But that's not the same as actually doing something. And so Eliza is very much a novelist. She has a novelist sensibility, and I was just interested in the limits of that sensibility. Like, obviously I'm a novelist and I like novelists for the most part, but I don't confuse them with, you know, philosopher kings or activists or people of action. And in fact, when you look at the writers in London during this period, in their relation to what was going on in the colonies and in the Caribbean islands, it was a relationship of irony. You know, they discussed it, they argued about it, they thought about it. But the people who actually did something were the working people of England en masse. It was not Dickens or any of the writers sitting around tables in London.
Yeah, because she is. Partly because of Frances, the first wife of William, she becomes active in the abolitionist movement.
Right.
But I mean, Eliza is also a person. I mean, she is also carrying her own deceit or her own secrets.
She is. I mean, that's another thing which I think kind of interested me about the period like sometimes when I was still teaching and dealing with my students, I realized that they had a view, a kind of like Philip Larkin-esque view, that sex was invented in about 1968. And I was just fascinated by that idea that you could think that or believe that or think that there were sexual acts that only recently came to light, or that people had only just thought, oh, maybe this could go in this hole, just like last Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Whereas obviously people have been having all kinds of sex since the beginning of time, but what was missing is language for it. So that interested me, that these generations of people who were doing everything that we were doing without a strict terminology for it, and what that might mean. I think from the point of view sometimes of my students, that could only be imagined as a terrible loss. And I don't say it isn't a loss. Like obviously we need language for things like our rights. But in the case of lesbians in England in the 19th century, of course, it's an interesting ambivalent case, because while homosexual men were being legislated against exactly because there was a language to define them, Queen Victoria, when asked about it, about lesbians, said, well, they don't exist, so there's no problem here. So there was no law. So that's an interesting example of the way that language, though it can be used in these incredibly liberating ways, is also, of course, a system of control, and it's something that's used in the law. So sometimes to be without language is not only a sadness or an absence, it might also be an opportunity. So I don't really think of Eliza as a terribly repressed person. I think in some ways, in terms of the way she thinks, she's a lot freer in that she doesn't wake up every morning and get her marching orders from a phone, or she doesn't what she is interested in is what she's interested in. And that seems to me quite a massive form of freedom, one that I quite miss, actually.
Yeah, but she really has this ability to observe her surroundings. She has this extreme eye for everything. But I mean, she also lives two unfulfilled loves.
Yeah, she does. I mean, you know, some of life is going to be unfulfilling. It's important to recognize that about life.
That's
it's
true.
Not going to be an endless parade of fulfillment and joy every minute of the day. So no, she doesn't have that. But you know, I guess I am interested in limits of all kinds. You know, human limits, because I think limits are human. We are limited in various ways. And one of the things I wanted to do with Eliza is not have contempt for her. Like obviously, Eliza, for example, is not Frederick Douglass. But Eliza is a very small part of an enormous abolitionist movement. And the fact that she plays a small role in it, I don't say that you give her the crown, but it's possible as adults with ethical discernment to say, well, Frederick Douglass is here and Eliza is here and William is nowhere in this movement. And that anyone who plays some role is doing something. I guess that's all I mean. When I think about the environmental movement, I feel the same, that if you judge yourself only by the standards of Greta, then you fall very quickly into despair. No? Greta took a boat to New York. Greta's saving the world. What am I doing? Well, you could do something like, you could just stop buying plastic water bottles. Just stop doing that. Just stop it. Just never buy another one. That would be amazing. Just do that. Just start there. Never buy another one of those things. And that would be incredible. That would just be something that you did that would actually make a fucking difference. So these kind of small things are not irrelevant, but they're not to be overstated either. But Eliza is somewhere on that, you know, continuum. She is involved. And she's also limited. You know, there are things she can't manage. She's not a radical. She's not able to understand what more radical characters in the book are trying to explain to her. She is a limited person by definition. Yeah.
Yes, but and also, I mean, there's another completely absorbing character for me in this novel, and that is Andrew Bogle.
Yeah.
He's a formerly enslaved Jamaican who is serving as a witness for the claimant. And also, Eliza feels a very strong bond to him somehow. Who is he?
I think one of the things which is useful in, if you're interested in solidarity, political solidarity movements, is interests. Like, you have to take an interest in what's happening in communities that are not your own. And I suppose from one point of view, Eliza's interest in Andrew is inappropriate. Like, she's completely fascinated by this Jamaican. I guess we've pathologized that kind of interest in movies like Get Out or whatever, to comic effect, like that you shouldn't touch our hair or be curious about us, and vice versa. The curiosity should be within bounds. But to me, in the community I grew up in, that kind of curiosity is the beginning of solidarity. Mm. So like my curiosity about, oh, what do the Pakistanis next door, what's their deal? Or the Irish people or the Jews downstairs, what's going on with these people? What is their issue? And that kind of solidarity in my childhood in the 80s enabled us to march together for diverse causes, you know, from South Africa to what happened in Bhopal in India. These are issues of solidarity. So for me, that kind of interpersonal curiosity is not a crime. In fact, it might be the basis of working together. So her curiosity is inappropriate, very profound. And it's just the curiosity of not knowing. She really doesn't understand where Andrew's from, what he might have gone through, what his life consists of. She just has no clue. Mm. And so part of the novel is taken up with him telling her. What she does with that information is mixed, but it was interesting for me, just because it's my background too, these are of course my ancestors on plantations in Jamaica, to think through what that experience was like, what it meant to the people who actually underwent it. Yeah. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, but also since Eliza is sort of this author's eye, I mean, we see it through her eyes, but she also gives us the opportunity to perceive things in her surroundings.
And also, it's not realism, is it? It's impossible that a man sits down in a cafe and tells you 80 years of history. That's not happening. One of the things about fiction is that it can create these areas in which the impossible occurs, in which you're hearing the story of Andrew Bogle supposedly told to Eliza, which is then conveyed to us. But it's important to recognize about novels that everything about novels is absurd. When you open a novel and a voice is speaking to you for 400 pages, that is by definition an absurdity. Mm. So it's artifice from the beginning. So I guess what I'm trying to do is play with that artifice and to these impossible states that don't exist in our real lived lives. In our real lived lives, stories cannot exist in three different places at once. But in fiction, they can. And so to me, that was a very thrilling thing to write, to try and imagine Bogle's life through Bogle's eyes. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, but he's also a character in the novel that has a lot of energy. He's very, I mean, he has something. He gives something to the novel. And what about you? When you found this material and started to read and do research on this case, what was it with Bogle that fascinated you the most?
I mean, first of
maybe
all,
you
from
could
historical,
also tell a little bit who he is.
He's a real person. He was born on a plantation in St. Andrews. My family are from just next door, St. Elizabeth. One of the unusual things about Jamaican plantations, well, I don't know if it's unusual, but when they closed down, most Jamaicans just stayed exactly where they were. So there's a very good chance, when you think of your Jamaican family, that wherever they are is where they were enslaved. There was not that much travel outside of these areas. So Bogle is a familiar name from that part of Jamaica. He was there. He was taken off the land by a member of the Tichborne family to become a servant in England when he was about 24. Mm. And then he ended up being a witness in this case. And so, as far as I know, and no one has told me I'm wrong yet, his testimony provides one of the longest narratives, I guess, of a Jamaican in Victorian England, because he was on the stand altogether for about 3 years, just talking. And there's 12 volumes of him talking, and it was in all the newspapers. And so it's quite unusual as a resource. And reading through that testimony, my main thought was the same as Borges, who read this case too and wrote a little short story about it 45 years ago. is that Bogle is an incredible storyteller. You know, to stand in court and talk for that long is a real feat. You know, it's a kind of narrative achievement. And the other thing about his story is that though he seems to be giving a lot of information, it's also very protected. So he doesn't, as a writer might, bleed on the page. He's very emotionally distant and controlled. He's funny a lot of the time, but he doesn't get on. He doesn't give the people what they want, and I found that very interesting too. Because I think that one of the things we expect of oppressed people is that, as well as their oppression, they owe us their story in great dramatic detail. We want to hear about how many times you were whipped and how awful the master was. And he doesn't do any of that. And so I felt like when I was writing it, I wanted to maintain the dignity he had on that stand, which was not to minimize anything that he had experienced or that he knew, but it was not to make a spectacle of himself for the appreciation of newspaper readers. So in my novel, I mean, there's plenty of novels you can read with terrible scenes of brutal slavery. They're everywhere. But I wanted to really talk about the system, where the money was, how it functioned, who benefited from it. That was what interested me. I don't think anybody reading those pages, if you can't see how brutal plantation slavery was, I don't know what to. I don't know how to help you. But I wasn't going to. I just took his lead on that matter. Yeah.
And it becomes, I mean, the untold becomes very present in the novel in this case. But also, why is he witnessing? Is there an answer to that?
The simplest explanation, I think, this is Borges's assumption too, is that if you had been brought up in that system of racialized capital and then you came to England and then you saw the opportunity, because if they'd won the case, they would have won all of Tichborne's lands in Hampshire. It's a substantial estate. It still exists. The house has been sold, but a lot of land. So I think it's a way of getting reparations. It's a kind of informal land grab for money and land, which he was more than owed, of course. So it's a kind of way of getting your, in American terms, your 40 acres and a mule directly from the British government. I think it was a bet, and then it didn't work out. You know, he could have, he already had £50 a year, which is not nothing, from the Tichborne family, but I think he wanted more, he deserved more. He bet the farm, as we say in England, and he lost.
Yeah, he did, but I mean, yeah, and he still told something very, he's very, it's very, in the novel, he's a very absorbing character, I find.
He's really my favorite and the most heroic. He has a son who, he had many children, actually. He married two different white women and had a lot of mixed race children. And one of them, Henry, was in court with him. And Henry in the book is a radical. He's a young radical. And he gives the most persuasive political arguments in the book. He is the most enraged. And Bogle, I guess there is a kind of oppression where you can't afford to be that enraged. And that is Bogle's situation, that he really can't afford, that he doesn't have the luxury of the kind of political arguments that his son makes. He's in a much more straitened position. So I find that quite moving, that idea of someone who suffered to such an extent and is really in the business of trying to survive. He's just trying to survive, yeah.
Which is also shown in the relation between the son and the father. I mean, it's very...
It's always hard. Like, when you're younger, I remember thinking that about, you know, my elders and my grandmother who worked as an orderly in a hospital. You think, why are you, you know, taking trays of people's shit around? Why aren't we burning down this country? And as you get older, you realize, oh, well, this woman is trying to feed seven children, so it's not really your business to judge what she's doing in this hospital. So I think that's something that you learn a little bit with age, that each generation does what is necessary.
Mm. Mm. But I mean, the novel is also, I mean, apart from this huge theme that I think is very central, it's also, I mean, it depicts deceit and fraud in so many ways, not least in the fantastic depiction of the falsehoods of the literature scene and its coteries and its grandiose author personas and so on, but also, I mean, through the readings of Eliza, of William's works, his ongoing manuscripts and so on, it's almost as we enter the world of I mean, the treacherous nature of literature itself and of life itself. So, I mean, sometimes we hear so many phrases like this, and now I'm going to, you have to excuse me because I'm going to translate from the Swedish translation, so it's going to be a lot of errors. He wasn't what he seemed to be. She that never wore masks and therefore was clearly impossible to grasp. The limit between a courtroom and a theater was far finer than she'd thought. Novels are made of such stolen truths. Is the victory of truth really love? There was a parenthetical place in her brain where things were true and false at the same time. I mean, it's almost, I mean, how was it when you wrote this novel? I mean, it's almost like the question of lie is sort of generating itself in the novel. You know what I mean?
I don't really believe, I could, I know it's out of step with the times, but I don't really believe in personal authenticity in that way. I think most of our social lives are fictions, the necessary fictions. The way you are in the office, the way you are with your friends, That really is. I think there's anything sinful about it. It's what we need to do to be around each other.
Mm.
And then what used to happen is a concept of privacy, an intimate space in which you are something closer to yourself. Maybe when you're alone, or when you're with the person you love, or with your family, or there's a kind of intimate place of withdrawal in which you can exist. And I guess what's hard, and what the Victorian period made hard, and which our digital era has made hard, is when you insist on everything being public-facing and everything being perfect for everyone, and having no intimate space and no space to withdraw, you end up lying all the time about everything to everybody. And I think that is really tiring. It's really tiring to live that way. It's really exhausting. And I think the Victorians found it very tiring, and I think a lot of people now find it really tiring.
Yes, because it's a very, it's a mirror completely in that sense.
It's really tiring, and I think people deserve and need privacy.
Mm.
It's what you need to be a human being.
Mm.
You can't do it without that. You need some space where your mask comes off and you just, where you can be. And if you don't, if that space becomes almost non-existent, it becomes really hard to be a human. Mm.
But it's also, I mean, putting this case of this scamster in the center, then it sort of highlights all the different lies that are going on between people.
I think it's an open lie, which is much more enjoyable. Like when Mark Zuckerberg said that thing at the beginning, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about. That is a fascistic vision of human life. Everybody has something to hide. That's what being a human is. Mm. And someone who thinks otherwise doesn't understand what humans are. Mm. So that something about an obvious lie in a corrupt system, it feels very refreshing. I think for me, the analogy is not Trump or any of that. It's O.J. Simpson, who was another unbelievable liar in the middle of a completely corrupt system. So when that case went through courts, it went through a court that was historically racist, had been racist for the entirety of history in America. So it was really hard for white Americans to understand what was going on in that court case, but it certainly wasn't about whether OJ had killed anyone or not. So nobody wants systems to change that way. Nobody wants people like OJ or people like Tichborne to be the engine of change. Mm. That's a nightmare, but sometimes it happens.
Mm, yeah.
When it feels like there's no other route. And in the Tichborne case, it did work. Like the second trial, there were two trials. In the second trial, for the first time in English history, the jury was entirely working class. It was self-consciously chosen from the working class. And after the OJ case, it was a practice was made of never again having all white juries to judge to judge black Americans. So these are kind of monstrous populism that sometimes feels like the only thing that can change a system that is stuck.
That's very interesting. Yeah, because I mean, the claimant, the character of the claimant is the character of a man without center, it says somewhere. He's almost like this. He is there, but he's also this. You get this feeling of an empty shell that absorbs the energies of his surroundings,
right.
but himself he stays impenetrable somehow. So who or what is he in that society, and what is that kind of character? I mean,
people have said it about Trump that sometimes you want somebody to kind of be a vehicle for all of your most activistic feelings, and people appear in that form. They're like fictional characters come to life, and there's some kind of great enjoyment in using them in that way. You know, in getting out all your you're yelling and you're screaming, and for in Tichborne, he presented in this schizophrenic way, the same way Trump does, as a poor rich man.
Mm.
OJ did the same, right? He was a black white man, white because rich. So I think these characters are a way of working through those kind of contradictions we feel as communities. It's a way out. It's not, of course, my preferred way out. I would much prefer it if we could have reasonable and rational politics. But I am aware at times reasonable and rational politics go nowhere, and then these explosions occur.
Mm. And it's also, I mean, since the novel has this labyrinth composition somehow. I mean, it's composed of short chapters, flashes, situations, short inner monologues, and so on. It becomes this jigsaw puzzle. It's sort of a case study evolving somehow in many different layers. And it's sort of we walk through, we get new clues or something, and the different characters start to highlight each other in different ways. So
you know what you're describing, Hannah? Reading. What we used to think of as reading.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Yeah, but maybe this reading experience has this very distinct feeling of that you are entering this kind of rooms that open, and also this feeling that the character starts to mirror each other. I mean, William is also this character that is mirrored with the claimant. I mean, somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of the structural stuff, we were talking a bit about it backstage. I don't sit at home thinking, how can I make a really difficult novel to annoy people? That's not...
No, but it's not difficult.
But what I do think is, it's a real problem if we started to believe that the kind of ready-made forms that are given to us, particularly, I mean, I grew up on television, so I'm very familiar with them, these kind of linear structures, that's real. That's not real. That's not how life feels. Life does not feel like a half an hour sitcom or like a 2,000 word blog post or like, that's not real. That is form. And you get so used to it that you start to become unable to recognize anything else as life unless it comes in your little three act. But that's not how life feels. Life is, to me anyway, is very ruled by emotion. Memories come to you as you feel them. Things are ordered in terms of how much they meant to you, not their perfect chronological order. So, you know, when I'm reading books, I'm thinking about realism as, like, Ulysses to me is a book of realism. That's how it feels to be alive. That's what I'm interested in, not these little genre conventions of what life is meant to be. Mm. So I think there are times in our literary lives where we can become extremely conventional and forget that there's any other way to skin a cat than this way. Mm. And I it does strike me sometimes talking to readers about this book that really what I wanted, just to remind myself, because I'd read so many novels recently which just literally start with a person speaking, they speak for 85 pages and we're done, just directly at me about the way they feel about things. I wanted to remind myself that it's possible to read in other ways. I was looking back at the books we were all reading in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and I thought, how did we read these books? We seem like incapable of reading these books now. Why are we incapable of reading books in this way, or of imagining that a voice can come from more than one place, that there might be multiple ways of reading something, that we are readers? Like, I really want to write books that are worthy of human beings who have like incredible capacities for comprehension, for organization, for narrative. Like, we used to have all those capacities. Mm. So part of writing it was just purely directed at myself. Like, I know when I'm reading online, I'm skipping over paragraphs. I'm basically getting got it, bye. And that's not, and so when you're confronted with a book, it's like, what the fuck? What?
Yeah.
Why? What? Every book suddenly seems like an incredible demand on your ability to look down a page and not gather in a few seconds what the basic vibe of the book is. So I wanted to remind myself what reading is. You know, it's the same as when you walk into a busy bar and there's a lot of people. You have to do a lot of things simultaneously. You have to work out who's in here, what kind of people are they, who am I talking to, what do they want to hear, what do I get from that? That's being a human. That's called being a human. And so for me, good books reflect that multivalent experience of being alive.
Yeah, and I mean, also, I mean, the whole novel, we follow, I mean, we jump forward and back in time also. I mean, and this is also Eliza reflecting upon her life and her different relations and the things that went wrong and the things that she wanted but never got and so on. It's also this very mourning or melancholic level to the novel in this way how you composed it. But how was the process for you? I mean, as always in your books, there is this enormous drive in the language. It's almost like you get the feeling that you let out a monster and it just, you know, it self-generates and it's, you know, just rah, right.
Yeah. Yeah,
is that how it is when you write? Or?
Yeah, in this case, it really, you know, the older I've got, the more I want to make the scene, you know, just appear. Mm. Like, I don't need metaphors or similes or decoration. I understand people like that in fiction, but I don't actually. All I want is to see, I want these things to be in my mind. I want to as if I could reach out and touch them, like a clarity. Mm. And there are writer amazing, like we're talking about Sally Rooney backstage. She's a writer for me who does exactly that. The clarity is just there. Those people are in my mind. It's like a magic trick. And that kind of fiction, I really love, and I like that directness. So writing this, it was really, a lot of it felt like that. Like, I was just walking into these rooms and here were these people, and all you had to do was get it down. But whenever a book's going well, that's how it feels. Yeah.
Mm. But did you have to move around a lot or
no? I think my mind, you know, if I was going to theorize about it, I think it's something to do with being in a minority. So if you're part of a majority, when you write, you can write in a straight line because you're aware that everybody, you're on the same, you think you're on the same page, rightly or wrongly, you make an assumption that you're on the same page as the people reading around you. So things don't have to be explained. I think when you come from any kind of minority, you are aware that there is a kind of shadow being on the page, which is what the majority thinks of this minority. So you're always kind of writing around it, behind it, trying to kind of, like Muhammad Ali, you've got to be nimble to get away from this thing, which is part of the reader's consciousness, this concept. So I think my novels have always had a weird shape because right in the middle of them is the cliche or the stereotype or the assumption or the, so you have to kind of dance around what you're aware is the assumption of the reader. Mm. So I guess in this case, the assumption of the reader is that it's that for a black writer, Andrew Bogle should be, for example, the narrator of this book. There's a typical assumption of a white reader, for example. I'm trying to demonstrate is that the system of slavery existed simultaneously with people talking about literature, with parties, with English life going on as if nothing was going on. That's what I'm trying to demonstrate. So the novel is a, to me, a structural recreation of the situation.
Mm. Yeah, and also you have, I mean, like in all of your books, you have such an ear for the vocal and the way people talk and interact and so on. But it's also, I mean, there's a lot of descriptions of literary writing, of fiction, the nature of authors. And there's sort of this joyful level to it that I find interesting because it's almost like there's a certain pleasure there in writing about writers.
Yeah, I mean, I love writers. I just don't think you should let them run your country or...
No.
Or you probably shouldn't marry them too often or, you know, there's a lot of things you shouldn't do with them, but I like them, find them very pleasant company and I enjoy them. So I enjoy... thinking about them and writing about them, but I just have a sense of their limits, of my limits. You know, I grew up at a time where if you came to an event like this, which I didn't do very often, but if I did come, there'd be some writer on stage talking about the power of imagination and the beauty of creativity and the power. And you just want to shoot yourself listening to these guys go on and on about the great importance of their art. So I grew up listening to that and knowing that it was bullshit. Almost all of it was just bullshit. So I'm allergic to that kind of talk, but I'm also aware as a reader, much more than a writer, that books have changed my life and do change my thinking and have structured my world. But I just don't think it's something that you can assume or pregame or flatter yourself about, because even though books do have that effect on me, I'm aware that the people who are writing them out of a sense of compulsion for the most part, you know, or because of their sad childhood or whatever it was. Like, it's not a virtue. It's like a kind of psychological condition from which other people incidentally sometimes benefit.
But it's also, I mean, it's also this, now we have not so much time left, but it's also an historical novel. I mean, this, I suppose, what was the greatest difference between writing your other books?
No difference to me, really, because the language is not Victorian. I guess some people think it is, but if you read a Victorian novel, they don't sound anything like this novel. So to me, it's just my voice, really, and I try not to say anything too anachronistic, but the language isn't particularly antique. For me, it was just a bit of, it was fun because I was becoming aware again, just from talking to people and teaching and being around people, that that our concept of the Victorian period was becoming more and more banal and flat and just untrue. So part of it was just a way of rescuing the past from this flattening, you know. And it became quite amusing, like in the edit, particularly in the American edit, like editors asking me things like, I don't understand why is Andrew Bogle described as a person of color in the newspaper report? And I'm like, because that is the phrase. It's 1872 and that's how he's described in the newspaper report. Or why is he in court giving testimony? Well, because there was no law against black people giving testimony in an English court in 1872. So it's really interesting realizing the limits of what people think they know about the past. And also, I guess, trying to tell a story that's particular to England, to Jamaica, and isn't American. is about the particular history of my particular country, which has all the brutality one might hope for. It's not a question of whether one country is more brutal or more racist or all these kind of childish questions. But the point is, it is different. I'm not an American. This is not American history. And it's different. And so I think all of us as Europeans or Caribbeans or Africans, I think, feel this need to say, we also have history. It's not yours. And you do not own us. And it's not, you know, it feels very oppressive sometimes, a kind of American colonialism of thought. So part of it was also a kind of fighting back to the particularities of my history, my country and my people.
But to work with the archive, the documented lives that have been lived and so on, do you also find that there comes a certain responsibility for a writer to when you start to approach?
Yeah, that was completely different, particularly with Bogle. Like I was so scared to write those Jamaican sections, partly because I don't like to write sentimentally. And I knew I was dealing with a history which is very close to my own. So the thing about British slavery is it's really not that long ago. So, you know, you can trace it in your own family. It's not that many generations. So I'm really talking about my great, great, great grandparents. Well, it's not that far back. So that's a weird thought to think that, and to think that I'm describing their days. So I wanted to be as accurate as possible. And again, there's that fear. As I was trying to read about Jamaica, I realized that what I'm describing is not recognizable to an American audience. They have a very set idea in their heads from that TV show Roots and from 12 Years a Slave or whatever. They think they know what this was. But in the Caribbean, it has a particular form. And so I knew as I was describing it, I'm working again with the shadow text, the shadow knowledge. And for me, the thing which gave me confidence in the end was reading an essay by Primo Levi about Auschwitz. It's called The Grey Zone. And it's a very interesting and very angry essay he wrote quite late in his life before he killed himself about the nature of the concentration camps and of the Polish ghetto. And what he's trying to describe is the fact that of the involvement of various Jews at different parts of that system. And he is aware that when he tries to talk about that, there are people from who never were anywhere near that situation who will then judge the different roles Jews played in this system. And his argument is, it's a fascinating argument. He says, I was there, and it may be that I make ethical differences between the man who helped clear the Polish ghetto for the Nazis and myself or my friend, but you are not a person to make that judgment. If you've never been in hell, don't tell me what you would do in hell. And I thought that I found it a relief, because I knew how many Jamaicans worked at the plantations at levels of seniority, because white people died so quickly. Most of the Jamaican plantations were run by black people at every level. And I knew that writing that to an American it doesn't compute, right? They cannot understand it in this binary system they have. So reading the Levy, I was like, I'm trying to explain what it's like to operate in hell. In hell, you will do many things to survive, and people did many things to survive. And Bogle is an overseer in that sense. There were many black overseers. One of the things you could do as an overseer is protect your children from the worst of it, for example. And I imagine there's a lot of people who make such a choice in such a situation. So it was trying to write the truth while also being aware of this banal conversation that goes around these things, but then not being scared to write the truth. Because if you judge Andrew Bogle for that, I mean, this is inconceivable to me.